Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. When hurricanes hit, the storm surges and flooding that follow can be more devastating than the winds. But in Houston, where tens of thousands of people have been displaced by Hurricane Harvey, just 15% have flood insurance. Coming up, we'll hear about why so few own flood insurance and what it could cost the rest of us. Joining us now by phone is New York Times reporter Mary Williams Walsh, who has been covering the aftermath of Harvey in Texas and Irma in Florida. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
In Texas, what's the estimated tab so far?
Oh, I'm not even sure they know, but I've heard as the claims come in, maybe $8
billion. $8 billion. And what are people doing in the meantime? What does the city look like?
So this is the funny thing. I'm reporting on the flood insurance issues, and I'm doing it by phone from New York. I have colleagues who are actually on the ground in Houston, and it's really spotty. I mean, I'm looking at maps and seeing strange things, but I'm not actually standing in knee-deep water myself.
The flood insurance issue, how does it work? Do people really even know? I mean, is it easy if you have the insurance?
No, it's not. There's more than one problem with the program. The private sector insurers haven't written flood insurance since the 1960s, basically. There's a little of it that goes on, and they do write it for big businesses. But just for residential insurance, your homeowner's policy probably doesn't have anything about flood in it. And if you want flood insurance, you have to go to the federal government for that.
Why did flood insurance become something separate?
It's probably the most expensive natural disaster there can be. Like, an insurer doesn't want to cover it because one good hurricane like Harvey can just wipe you out. And so they stopped writing it. When you sell premiums, you're supposed to be able to figure out, like, what's the connection between how much somebody has to pay and what would the ultimate cost of their claim be. And it's just too expensive. They wouldn't be able to sell it. So the federal government does that. The federal government, it's a very subsidized program.
If your house is blown away by Harvey, you're covered.
If it's wind damage, yes. The problem is the flooding. And in Houston, that was the problem. I mean, most of the damage from wind was closer to the coast. And then inland, there was flooding in places that no one expected there to be flooding, basically.
What about how they determine what floodplains are in Houston? How up to date are those charts?
Well, it's funny because they do have a brand new flood map this year in Harris County, which is where Houston is. And we figured out that more than half of the flooding happened in places that were not designated as floodplains. And so I'm not sure the problem is that the maps aren't up to date because they do have a brand new one. It's just that the way that a flood zone is designated probably doesn't reflect the most modern way of assessing risk.
Right. How the whole determination of a flood zone is outdated then. The National Flood Insurance Program, what role does it play in all of this?
So that's the one that if you are trying to buy flood insurance for your house and your insurance agent says you can buy anything you want for your house but not flood, then they would say, but I can get you a policy that's issued by the National Flood Insurance Program. So it's the federal government that is writing most of this. And what's supposed to happen is if your house is on a designated floodplain, you're actually supposed to buy it. And then most people somehow don't. I mean, there's more than one thing wrong. There can be flooding in places that aren't on the designated flood zones. And then there can be people who are on the flood zones who were supposed to buy insurance but never did. So it's like there's more than one thing wrong here. And then, you know, if your house floods and you have no insurance, it can be a total loss. It's a really, really expensive thing to repair.
If you're supposed to buy it, then how can people get away with not buying it?
There's not really an easy way of enforcing it. What's supposed to happen is when you get a mortgage, like if you're buying a house, if you're on a flood plain, the bank will make you buy the flood insurance. But then if you pay off your mortgage, there's no teeth anymore to force you to keep your policy updated. Or if you inherit property, which a lot of people do, you wouldn't have a mortgage bank in the picture anywhere. So no one would be telling you, you have to buy flood insurance. You're on a floodplain. You might hear about it sort of through the grapevine, or you might hear about it when there's a hurricane. But once the hurricane comes, you can't buy it anymore. It's too late. And so, like, if all of a sudden you're knee deep in water and your house is being destroyed, you're just stuck with a huge, huge damage.
So 85% of the people in Houston did not have flood insurance. Is that typical across the country, do you know?
this is a problem everywhere. I mean, there's a lot of inland flooding. It's not just hurricanes, mm-hmm. but a hurricane is a really good example. But if you look at the map of what flooded in Houston, it's very flat there, and they don't have drainage systems that are up to sort of like a huge rainfall like they got. And mm-hmm. so culverts washed out and ditches washed out, and water was just sort of going everywhere. And so there would be lots and lots of people who would not have known they even should have flood insurance, because they didn't, like, no one expected it to flood there the way it did.
Except for the experts and the insurance companies.
Yeah, they know not to sell any insurance for those places.
Right. That should be a big clue, right?
It's funny because there's a thing called reinsurance, which is like insurance for insurance companies. Uh-huh. And they actually do, like the National Flood Insurance Program has some reinsurance, and the reinsurance companies, they're risking their own money. So they are very careful about trying to get a good handle on what's on the ground that could get flooded. And they use totally different methods that the federal government doesn't have for whatever reasons. And so it's not impossible to find out like how big the risk is and to even pin it down to each individual house. It's the federal program. I think there's, you know, working so hard just to run this huge, gigantic program that they can't get into it the way the reinsurers do. And they don't have, they're not, it's not like a company risking its own shareholders' money. It would be like the federal government. And if the federal government doesn't price it right or doesn't have enough money for a hurricane, they can borrow from the Treasury up to a point. And so it becomes sort of like all taxpayers paying for this.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about what the cost of Harvey for the uninsured down in Houston, or the cost of Irma for the uninsured in Florida, is costing the rest of us, and what can be done. Coming up later in the program, we're going to hear from critics of that National Flood Insurance Program and what they recommend change about the program. If you have a question or comment right now for my guest, Mary Williams Walsh, she's a New York Times reporter who covers the insurance industry and the issues surrounding these hurricanes when it comes to insurance, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So with Hurricane Harvey, you wrote that roughly 40% of flooded buildings were in areas considered a minimal flooding hazard, and that's from the updated flood map.
Well, they have a brand new one in Houston.
Okay.
So it's new as of this year. It's not like it's a 30-year-old map that, you know, there aren't even buildings on that have been built since it was done. It is an up-to-date map. The flood insurance program just uses methods that they don't take into account certain things that, like, the reinsurers with their methods would take into account.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel as if they don't, somebody may correct me on this, but I've been told that they don't include elevation, which to me seems like that would be important. Like, the elevation can, of course, affect if you're going to be flooded or not. I think they can't get, I think they don't have like granular data down to parcel by parcel, which the reinsurers, they know what's there. It's going to cause a lot more damage if a house blows down than if, you know, a cornfield or something like that gets hit or flooded. So,
right.
So the information can exist. It's just sort of like two different, totally different approaches. And one is a lot more granular than the other.
I was listening to an interview last week with a developer in Houston, a very prominent developer, someone who's built a lot of the high-rises and a lot of the homes. And he said they'll rebuild. After something like this, is there any barrier in place to force Houston to reassess where and how it builds out?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. It's there is more than, like, if you were going to change this program and get it to run the way everybody wants it to run, one of the things that you would work on is, like, not just paying to rebuild stuff in places where the people are just going to be exposed to more hurricanes and more floods and more danger. I mean, it's dangerous to be there if there is a storm. And in the past, that hasn't existed. And you hear these stories about houses that have been rebuilt 16 times already, and the government has paid, you know, more than $1 million for a house that's only worth $100,000 or something mm-hmm. like that. That would be one of the things you would want to work on. I'm not sure how you would do it, but you could have people maybe, okay, if you're going to buy flood insurance from the federal government, you have to pay this much, and you're going to get a discount if you do something to make it be more hurricane proof or more flood proof than it is now. Those incentives, I think, would help a lot. It's hard to get them into the law, though. This seems to be something that people have been working on for a long time, and it's hard to change the law.
There was a time, though, when they did upgrade or change the law back in the day, right?
There have been improvements, and some of them are still there, and others have been rolled back. One of the things people talk right. about a lot is risk-based premiums, so that, like, you should pay a premium according to how much risk you pose to the whole system. And there's all these people who have been living in some of these places just for generations. You know, if you inherited a farm close to the Mississippi Delta or something like that, and there's flooding risk, you sort of feel like, well, I was here before this risk, before this flood program was, and the federal government has no right to come in here and force me to. It's sort of like healthcare. Like, people don't want to pay the premiums, and they feel as if they shouldn't. And I'm doing the best I can, and you don't have any right to come in and impose new costs.
Except that they want to go walk into the hospital if there's an emergency.
And we want to have some help rebuilding if our house gets flooded, too.
Right.
Yeah.
How much does this cost the American taxpayer? Does anybody even know?
After everything was sort of going okay until Hurricane Katrina. I mean, the program was sort of breaking even if you averaged out, you know, some years there's a big flood and some years there isn't. But Hurricane Katrina, there was just so much damage and so much flooding. I think they had to borrow something like $17 billion from the Treasury that year. And it's never been paid back. The program is actually paying interest to the Treasury on that debt, which is sort of sad because, you know, the money that they have, you want to see it being used to rebuild things and not paying interest. But that's the situation. And it happened again after Hurricane Sandy. I think they borrowed another $8 billion or something. Anyway, it's up to about $25 billion. But it's just sort of like this big accumulation of losses from prior years. And the premiums are not enough. The premiums aren't enough to ever break even. They can't mm-hmm. they can't catch up.
So what does the National Flood Insurance Program do then? I mean, what are they talking about?
They do get in there, and they it's not as if they're sitting at their desks doing nothing. They mm-hmm. do a lot of stuff. They're remapping places. Like I said, the area around Houston just got a brand new flood map this year. It seems as if there's lots of arguing over what's going to be on a floodplain and what isn't. This problem of, well, you can't force me to buy insurance when, like, I'm a free individual and I shouldn't have to buy something from the federal government. There's that kind of thinking that goes on. So they fight lots of fights. And then Congress has to re-up the program. It's interesting now because they have a federal mandate that has to be reauthorized every year, I think, or every 5 years. Mm-hmm. And right now, they're in the reauthorization time, and right now is when we're having four back-to-back hurricanes. So everybody's sort of looking at the program carefully. And what I'm sort of wondering is this mean it's going to be easier for them to get some reforms, or are they in such a hurry now that they won't have time to? And I don't know the answer to that. Congress has to make a lot of the changes that that would be necessary to really improve the finances of this program.
A lot of those states, though, where these hurricanes hit are red states. They're conservative states.
It's true, but New York, and if you look at the states.
That's true. New Jersey, right, yeah.
They're up there in the five top flooding states, mm-hmm. like New York and New Jersey are. The other ones are Louisiana, Florida, and, of course, Texas. So it's sort of like not necessarily a pure red state versus blue state thing. They both have exposure.
The Trump administration's proposed budget would cut $190 million from the flood insurance program, specifically from the funds allocated for updating old flooding maps. Has anyone been talking about that? Now, of course, it's just a proposed budget. It's not necessarily going anywhere, but what about that?
Yeah, they are definitely talking about it. There's a lot of arguing about it, and it seems like there's a, you know, there's lots of fiscal conservatives that want to just kind of tighten up the program so that taxpayers who are in places that really almost never flood, so that they don't have exposure to stuff that goes on in Florida and the Gulf Coast. But there's a lot of disagreement about that, and Trump himself is sort of an unpredictable person on this. He knows this very well because he has a house on the coast of Florida. So mm-hmm. he does have flood insurance. He bought it from the federal program. And I mean, he's obeying the law. He's supposed to have that, and he does have it. But what I've been wondering is, does this make him be more sort of oriented toward compassion and understanding what it's like to be on the coast and not have, can he envision what it would be like to not have insurance? I don't know that.
Well, Mary Williams Walsh, thanks for joining us to talk about it. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
It's Mary Williams Walsh. She's a New York Times reporter covering the insurance issues facing places such as Houston and Florida, where the hurricanes and the storm surges are becoming untenable financially. Coming up, we're going to continue our conversation about this topic. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Hurricanes are known for their winds, but the storm surges that cause flooding are the real disaster in places such as Houston, where thousands continue to dig out after Harvey dumped nearly 53 inches of rain on the area. Despite warnings from scientists about the possibility of severe flooding in Houston, 85% of homeowners there don't own flood insurance. Joining us now by phone is a spokesman for the Insurance Council of Texas, Mark Hanna. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you.
The Insurance Council of Texas has placed the insured losses from Hurricane Harvey at $19 billion. What does that tell us about the uninsured losses?
Well, they're very high. As you mentioned, one in seven had flood insurance in Houston and Harris County. Those numbers are higher as you go along the counties along the Texas coast, but about as low as you're going to find is Houston and Harris County. And so you had over 100,000 homes that were flooded there. And with only one in seven, you've got a lot of uninsured, a lot of people who are in dire straits at the moment.
And were they, how many of those people were required but did not have insurance?
That's really unknown. Mostly, I would think that most of them, if they had a banknote and they were in a flood zone, they had to have. It was mandatory flood insurance. I think that the people that we're talking about were outside the flood zone where, again, when you have over 50 inches of rainfall, there's lots of areas that flood that have never flooded before.
Now, I was just talking with a reporter from the New York Times who said that there were brand new maps released of flood zones just last year, I think, right? In Houston?
Yes, it's kind of a continuing basis with new flood zones, yeah, especially for that area.
Is it clear? I mean, were they accurate?
Well, again, this is a one-in-a-thousand-year flood. It just kind of throws all of the books and everything out the window here. I mean, again, you're going to have flooding that you will never, ever see. And obviously, every area that was in a flood zone was highly flooded, and again, this was just, if you look at the flooding areas of just, say, Houston alone, I mean, it was just, the city was inundated.
Mm-hmm. A third of the city, right?
A third of a good guess.
Of yeah, a very large city.
Right, the fourth largest city in the country. And a lot of people leave out the fact that it wasn't just Houston and Harris County. Mm-hmm. We're talking 15 to 20 counties surrounding that make up a part of Southeast Texas that were underwater.
What is flood insurance exactly? What does it typically cover?
Well, it maxes out for residential at $250,000 for the structure of a home, and you can get up to $100,000 for the personal contents inside the home.
I know.
And this is rising waters. This is not wind-driven rain or anything else or sewer backups. This is rising water coming from floodwaters that that do a lot of damage, obviously.
There's the issue of overdevelopment in the Houston area. There's too much blacktop, too much cement, not enough spongeable land left to, you know, and even the land that is available isn't necessarily very spongy. Is the insurance industry, does it have a vested interest in changing the layout of a city like Houston, given the storms that there's been three big storms in the last few years?
You're exactly right. There's been three very serious flooding events there in Harris County in the last 3 years that have tens of thousands of vehicles and obviously lots of homes. This is really a federal government issue. The private insurance industry shies away from flood insurance. It's why they kind of shy away from, you know, insuring homes right along the beachfront because of storm surges and hurricanes. And it's boiled down. It's left to Congress on how they want to deal with it. And as you know, they passed legislation 3 or 4 years ago where they were looking at laddering the rates, raising the rates up to where they would be actuarially sound, and dealing with homes that were in harm's way. And because of the consumers' backlash, and they all vote, Congress mm-hmm. Rescinded all that legislation, and now we're back where we were.
Most insurance is provided by private firms. You're saying private firms don't want to get involved in this, but some do, right?
There are a handful of companies that do offer flood insurance for their policyholders. But for the most part, 98% of flood insurance is offered by the federal government.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the impact on the nation when a place like Houston or a place like Miami or wherever is inundated with floods after these big hurricanes, after these big storms. 85% of the people in Houston, 85% of the homeowners in Houston are not insured for floods. My guest right now is Mark Hanna. He's spokesman for the Insurance Council of Texas. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Are there different levels of flood insurance? So you said it maxes out. Could you get less than a max out? Would that cover the legality or legally cover you?
Well, it depends on the rebuilding of the home. If you've got a $50,000 home, there's no reason to buy $250,000 worth of flood insurance. The bank is going to look at the cost of rebuilding your home. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be mandatory that you cover the cost to rebuild that so that the bank can get their money back in the event that you lose the house.
So what happens with all those people who don't have flood insurance? Not very many people can afford to just pull it out of their hip pocket. What's going to happen to all that property?
Well, a lot of people are going to say, hey, this is the most valuable thing that I have. And they're not just going to walk away. Mm-hmm. They're going to try to rebuild. They're going to do everything that they can. They're going to seek every kind of financial assistance that's possible. There are relief funds set up throughout the Houston area. There's the Red Cross, the Salvation Army. There's family, friends, church groups, neighbors. And there's FEMA. And there's the chance, there's the hope that FEMA is coming to the assistance of not only the uninsured, but the insured there in the area. And it's just a question of how much money that they will get and when that will be forthcoming. It could take a while.
Are there, what about vehicles? You mentioned vehicles. Can they be covered as well? Is that part of the coverage?
The private industry covers vehicles.
That are flooded.
If you've got comprehensive insurance coverage with your insurance, with your auto insurance, you're covered for not only flood, but hail, tree coming down on your car, vandalism, burglary, theft. Mm-hmm. It's basically called other than collision. So about 75% or 80% of the folks in Texas had comprehensive coverage. So we found more people covering their vehicles than they did their homes.
You're down there, right?
I'm in Colorado at the moment, but I'm based in Austin.
How are people digging out now? So much of our attention was distracted by Irma and now Maria.
Well, it's easy to forget of past storms real quickly, mm-hmm. especially when you have the severity of Irma's and we have a Maria mm-hmm. that could be potentially coming this way again. People are digging out, like you said, and we've never had anything like this. Normally, when we have flooding, anywhere in the country, generally the next day you can get in there and take your carpet out, take your furniture out, and do the drying out process, which maybe in 2 or 3 days you've done it. But in this case, we've had homes that have been submerged for a week or longer, and you can just imagine the damage that's occurred.
What does the Insurance Council of Texas do?
We are a state insurance trade association. Insurance has its own rules, laws, and regulations different in every state. So if you're an ABC company that does business in all 50 states, you may have to rely on, well, what's going on in Texas? What's going on? You know, what are they doing with the legislature? What bills are there? So we follow all the legislation.
Mm-hmm.
We follow all the court rulings. We follow everything that the Texas Department of Insurance does. And then on the side, for our members, I follow every weather event that occurs in the state of Texas and put a price tag on it. And at the same time, we do a lot of good. We give away 20,000 smoke alarms to fire departments throughout the state, saving lives. And we do crime prevention programs. I do a hurricane tour. I was on my 12th annual hurricane tour going down the Texas coast, talking to 4 dozen members of the news media, radio, TV, and newspaper, telling people, get prepared for the hurricane season. This is what you need: windstorm and homeowners insurance and flood insurance, and you know how to be prepared. And I was in Corpus Christi on the 4th of my 5th day when the storm was going to hit the next day. So I evacuated with a lot of folks back to Austin.
I heard an interview on NPR, and they were interviewing a prominent developer in Houston, and he said that they're going to rebuild. They can bring it all back. Where's the wisdom in that? Does the Insurance Council of Texas have any thoughts about that?
Well, there are so many people out of their homes right now, and folks who are out of their apartments, and there are people going to be looking for places to stay, places to live. And these developers, hopefully in their wisdom, will be build a bigger, stronger, and much higher off the elevation ground so that they're out of harm's way. And it's inevitable. The city's going to build back. And they, right now, there's a lot of people who are looking for places for a shelter and a roof over their head.
Mm-hmm. And as far as businesses go, how much of that $19 billion in insured losses from Hurricane Harvey are business-related, or is that strictly residential that you're talking about there?
No, there's $11 billion that the federal government is going to be paying out for flood damage, and that's a part of that. It's residential and commercial business.
The Trump administration's proposed budget would cut $190 million from the flood insurance program, specifically from the funds allocated for updating old flooding maps. Now, I know you have a new flooding map, which didn't really work maybe as well as a lot of people hope it would. What about cutting costs on things like that? Is that something that matters to the Insurance Council of Texas?
Well, did you say million or did you say billion?
Million. But
well, with the program right now at $25 billion in debt,
right?
I'm not sure what kind of effect $190 million is going to have.
But
on.
It specifically would be coming from funds allocated for updating old flooding maps.
You would hope that nothing would be taken out of this, and they could redraw new maps and everything else. From a state perspective, you would hope that the federal government could tell exactly, you know, where harm's way might be, not only in Houston, but every other city and county across the country. And you wouldn't want that affected, but again, that's on a different level than what we're looking at.
Mark Hanna, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Mark Hanna, spokesperson for the Insurance Council of Texas. More on the flooding in Houston, what it costs the rest of us. When we return, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. On August 25th, Harvey came ashore as a Category 3 hurricane with 130-mile-per-hour winds just east of Corpus Christi in Texas. That and other hurricanes and related storm surges have left areas across Texas, Florida, and the Caribbean decimated. The Insurance Council of Texas has placed the insured losses from Hurricane Harvey at $19 billion in Texas alone, but just 15% are insured in Texas. At times such as these, many turn to the National Flood Insurance Program. We're going to talk about how that's going. Joining us by phone is the director of the Center for Risk Management and Insurance Research at Georgia State University's J. Mack Robinson College of Business, Robert Klein. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, and good morning.
Good morning. What we've been talking about, the National Flood Insurance Program. When was it founded? How long has it been around?
It was founded in 1968 to address what was perceived at that time as a lack of availability in private flood insurance. And also there was interest in integrating floodplain management with flood insurance. So that was when the program was created, and that was two of the motivators behind creating the program.
Has it had such a taxing year as this one?
Well, clearly, Katrina was a big one, as your previous guests have indicated, and that was a really big hit to the program, as was Superstorm Sandy. And now Harvey and Irma are going to have really heavy impacts on the program as well.
Is it set up to withstand these? We know that it's already $25 billion in debt.
No, it's not really set up, and there's several reasons for that, but basically it's not collecting enough premiums to cover the cost of these very catastrophic floods, and there's several reasons for that.
Why doesn't it price the premiums properly?
Well, some properties are subsidized, and that's part of the problem. The program also, and this gets kind of technical, but there's something called a catastrophe loading that private insurers put in their premiums to basically build up reserves for catastrophic losses, and the program has not really done that either. And then there's also this problem with these repetitive loss properties that I think one or two of your guests referred to, among other things. And basically, we're just not doing a very good job with respect to managing our floodplains and reducing the losses from these types of events.
There's every reason to believe, if you follow the science of the weather patterns changing, that this is going to become an increasing problem. How long can the NFIP, the National Flood Insurance Program, sustain itself? As long as there's money to print?
I guess as long as Congress is willing to allow it to borrow more money. I think it's got about $6 billion in borrowing authority left, and that, by my prediction, is going to be tapped out. I think Harvey and Irma are probably going to add at least $10 billion to that debt. So the Congress is going to have to appropriate more money just for that. And unless other fixes are made, that debt is just going to keep growing in future years.
The Congress in recent years has been willing to shut down the entire government to make a point about not wanting to increase the debt limits on itself, on the government. What is the relationship between Congress and the National Flood Insurance Program that lets them let this or this entity continue to take on debt?
Well, there's a lot of vested interest. I think, as your previous guest mentioned, there are people living in the coast and other areas that are very high risk, and they obviously want the program to continue, and they may be reluctant to pay the full cost of their insurance. If you shut the program down and you have this thing called the mandatory purchase requirement, which your guest referred to, then it throws a big wrench into the real estate market, because you can't sell new homes if you can't issue a mortgage on them.
But how much does it cost the rest of everyone else?
Well, it costs people in a couple ways. Clearly, the borrowing, somebody has to pay for that. Also, disaster assistance, and it is a bit of a myth that somebody's going to be made whole just by disaster assistance if they don't have insurance. Nonetheless, a lot of disaster money funded by taxpayers does go to these areas when they're hit by these heavy storms, including flooding. And so, you know, taxpayers are paying for that as well. And if there was more flood insurance where people pay for it in advance by premiums, then there would be less taxpayer funding of those costs as well.
If people want to rebuild and move back to where they lived before these hurricanes, does the federal government have a role in helping them do that if they weren't insured?
Potentially, yes. That has to do with, you know, these repetitive loss properties. And there are some programs in place to try to make it to sometimes give people the opportunity to relocate to safer areas, or also help them with elevating their property. So if they can put their properties up on stilts, if they're in a high-risk area, then that substantially reduces the likelihood that they'll get flooded. So there are those things in place, but they're not really adequate. And so much more needs to be done with respect to how we deal with these properties in areas that are going to be flooded over and over again.
Why are so many insurance policies through the National Flood Insurance Program subsidized, and how can I get subsidized on my insurance costs?
Well,
what's the trick there?
There's a couple of ways you can get subsidized, and I don't think there's time to explain it, but it's the subsidies kind of originated out of this notion that when flood maps were initially created, suddenly all these, you know, homes were designated to be in what were considered high-risk areas, and they said, well, let's give those people a break. And then when if you have a home in an area that's designated as just low or moderate risk, and then the flood map changes, and now you're in a high-risk area, your rate is grandfathered. So that is, you know, where these subsidies are mainly coming from. And I guess they're intended to, you know, give people a break if things change. But the subsidies are costly, and they suck revenues from the program in terms of its ability to cover all its costs.
Do we know how much the federal government pays out in subsidies for flood insurance?
I can't give you an exact figure on that, but it is substantial. It's not the, you know, CBO did a study which thought indicated that maybe the program would be solvent if it weren't for the subsidies. But my guess is that it's not just the subsidies, but it's the lack of this catastrophe loading and the rate that also contributes to that. And one of your guests mentioned about this thing about the debt. Right now, FEMA is required to make interest payments on the debt, to make principal payments, and that's also sucking money out of the program.
Flood maps will change as the weather patterns change and as flood-prone areas get built up. It's a scientific fact. Why aren't people forced to have to pay for the changing flood circumstances?
Well, it's politics and economics. It's a case of where you have very strong vested interest groups, particularly, say, in certain coastal areas, and not just the people that own homes there, but also real estate developers, builders, etc. And they're very resistant to having people in those areas pay the full cost of what it costs to insure them. And they represent a very strong political bloc.
Is NFIP fixable?
Well, in an environment where politics would be minimized, I would say yes. There's a lot been written on how to fix the flood program. You can't fix it without somebody bearing some pain, but it's fixable. The problem is that when you start allocating the pain of that, then that's where interest group politics come into play, and it makes it very difficult to get good reform done. There are currently three bills pending in the Congress that take different positions on this, and there's going to be a big fight, you know, as people try to move this legislation forward.
What would you do to fix it?
Well, if I were the emperor, I would make it all the rates actuarial based. I would put a cap load into the premiums. I would forgive the debt. I think it's impractical to pay it back. I would have policies dealing with these repetitive loss properties. So eventually these properties either get elevated or they just get demolished and people are given some help to move to safer areas. And it's also the case that, you know, some of the recipients of these subsidies are very wealthy people or fairly high income people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think there's a point where you have to say, taxpayers shouldn't have to pay for their subsidy. Now, I would favor means tested vouchers for low income people, whether it's to help them pay for their current flood insurance or help them relocate to a safer area.
Donald Trump insures his property in Florida through the National Flood Insurance Program. Would he be eligible for subsidies?
I'm not sure whether he's actually getting a subsidy or not. But I can't tell you whether his property is paying a full cost rate or not. It may or may not,
mm-hmm.
may not be, but it's possible he's not paying
because
full
currently
cost,
there
really
are
cost
no
to insure them.
Okay. Because right. there aren't means testing at this point.
Right. Well, the means testing would be, means testing would be set up in such a way that if you were considered to be, however you define it, a low-income family, and you were in a high-risk area, and you would have trouble affording your flood insurance, the voucher would help you pay for it. It wouldn't necessarily pay the full cost, but it would help you pay for at least part of it so you could afford it.
You said there's three bills pending in Congress. Have they been pending mm-hmm. for a long time, or are these...
Well, it's the new Congress, so, you know, they've just been pending since, you know, probably early summer.
Yeah.
And, you know, the ideas that are built into those bills are ones that have been around for a while. There's some new things in them. There's also a bill that would enable private insurers, make it easier for private insurers to sell flood insurers, and there is a lot of interest in that, including among private insurers, actually.
How would it make it easier for them? I mean, isn't it just a bottom-line issue?
Well, there are some things that private insurers can do that the NFIP can't do. They're more flexible and nimble. They can use better technology to more accurately price risk. They can make some changes in the policies themselves to make them more feasible to underwrite and to price. But there's going to be a limit to what private insurers can do, especially if they're competing with the NFIP, and the NFIP is not is charging rates below what the actual cost is.
If the NFIP didn't even exist and people couldn't get insurance at all, that would probably change development a lot, wouldn't it?
Yeah, probably over time, assuming that, you know, the federal government would not come in and pay everybody's losses. Yeah, that would be a big incentive for people to not build in those areas and for some other people to relocate if they could.
When you talk about politics getting involved in all of this, is this more of a regional politics issue than it is a blue or a white state kind of, I mean, than it is a Democrat or Republican?
Right. I think it's not just blue versus white or red or whatever.
Mm-hmm. It, it, I mean, blue or whatever, red. Yeah.
Right,
sorry.
Whatever.
I'm confusing my colors again.
That's all right. Yeah, definitely. It's the legislators who have constituents that live in high-risk areas know that, and they very much tend to advocate, you know, from what their interest is. There is sort of a conservative ideology reflected in one of the bills, and the other two bills reflect more of, you know, the impact of interest groups, politics, and a liberal view of what we should do.
What's the liberal view?
Well, the liberal view is that we should be, the government should do more to help people that live in these high-risk areas. And I think that's, you know, at least one element of that. There's also some skepticism about whether charging people full actuarially based rates make sense in among some of these legislators, or they just have other issues that they have a different point of view versus the more reform-minded legislators have.
You mentioned that the NFIP is not as nimble as like private insurance interests when it comes to updating and drawing conclusions about where and what premiums should be and that kind of a thing. Why is that? Why can't it be more nimble?
That's a good question. I mean, it is a bureaucracy, so maybe there's something to that. I think if Congress forced it to be more nimble, it could be. So I'm not one of those that's, you know, inclined to just say, you know, it's incapable of doing the job right. Mm-hmm. I just think it needs more help. And one of those things is more funding. You mentioned the Trump administration proposing an $190 billion cut in flood for the spending for flood risk mapping.
Right.
Two of those bills that I mentioned would significantly increase the funding for flood risk mapping, as well as other flood risk mitigation efforts that FEMA is involved in. And that's an important thing to know. FEMA does more than just map floods and provide flood insurance. They help communities undertake measures to make flooding less likely or less damaging. And those types of programs need to be boosted, not cut back.
The flood maps, are you confident that the flood maps and the processes that they're using to update flood maps at this point are the best methods? Are they the most scientific?
No, I think, as one of your previous guests indicated, they need to be using more advanced technologies. And the NFIP is making some strides in that direction, but I think they could do a lot more and they could do it faster. So, yes, flood risk, I would call flood risk assessment, could be done much better using the best technology available. And it could be more real time so that you're not just constructing a new flood map every 3 or 4 years or whatever, but the information could be updated on a more real time basis and then made widely available to everyone, including homeowners. So they get better under, they can at least find out, you know, where they stand and what their risk is on a more real time and accurate basis.
Why can't there be more enforcement of the requirement that you have insurance if you live in a floodplain?
Very good question. It's estimated about 50% of the people that are subject to this requirement actually don't have flood insurance. So right there, the enforcement of that alone is a big problem, and that needs to be tightened. So that means pushing the banks to do more to make sure it's enforced, increasing the fines and penalties if they don't enforce the requirement. There's also the issue that this requirement does not apply to people with mortgages that live in so-called moderate or low-risk areas. And these storms and other storms have demonstrated these areas also can be flooded. So one idea would be to extend this requirement to people with mortgages that live outside of these high-risk areas. And that's something that could be done. Admittedly, it would generate some controversy.
Does any of the onus rest with city planners who continue to let development, cover areas like Harris County, Houston, and that?
Definitely. This is not just a federal issue. This state issue, this is a local issue. Everybody has a role here in trying to do things to make flooding less likely and the damages from flooding less likely. So zoning needs to be tightened, building ordinances need to be tightened, a lot of things, more wetlands need to be retained and restored. There's a lot of measures that could be taken to reduce the incidence of flooding and the damages it caused, but it's a local, state, and federal thing.
Robert Klein, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. It was good to be on your show.
Robert Klein, Director of the Center for Risk Management and Insurance Research at Georgia State University's J. Mack Robinson College of Business. Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.